Welcome back to another episode of Slay House Presents. I'm your host, Trevor. Today, I am joined again by special guest, S.A. Barnes. She is the author of Dead Silence and the forthcoming Ghost Station. Works in a high school library by day, recommending reads, talking with students, and removing the occasional forgotten cheese stick as bookmark. Barnes has published numerous novels across different genres. She lives in Illinois with more dogs and books than is advisable and a very patient spouse.
Yes, that's me. Hi, thank you for having me.
I am so excited to have you on again to talk about Ghost Station this time. Before we jump into this conversation about the book, though, I have to ask, how has the student reception been to Dead Silence? Because I see social media posts sometimes from your account talking about how your book circulates. And I just got to know, what's the reception been like?
You know, it's really funny. When it first came out, I had several kids like either email me or approach me directly and say how much they enjoyed it or they really liked it. And it was lovely. It was really cool. And then, you know, when the book came out, I was very fortunate that my school was very supportive, and I got to do, I think, 4 talks in one day where they had like all the English classes. It's a high school of about 2,200. So I saw a lot of kids that day. And so then that's been a couple of years ago. So some have graduated, some have come in, and I never know, you know, if whatever. So every once in a while, somebody will bring it up to the desk and I'll have to say, you know, this is my book. And they'll look at me and go, yeah, I know. they're like super not impressed with me at all. And that's fine. You know what? They check the book out. They like it or they don't. That's okay. I did just have on, was it Friday? Yeah, yesterday, a group of boys who are freshmen. They didn't know. I was telling them something about I was going to be doing, you know, book promotion stuff for Ghost Station. I'm like, you wrote a book? I'm like, uh-huh. and I showed them Dead Silence, and they were like reading through the bio in the back, and they're like, yeah, forgotten cheese stick. That's really good. That's really good, Miss K, because that's what they call. And I'm like, okay, thank you. They're just kind of hilarious. So like to them, it's just no big deal. I'm just, you know, the person in the library who makes them sign in and tells them to be quiet and not to eat. And the ones who read the book, they're, you know, then it's a little different than there's a student who works at Barnes & Noble who has just been lovely. There's a Barnes & Noble not far from the school. And, you know, is there anything, you know, do you need me to do? Can I, you know, I'm like, no, that's great. I'm good. You know, we're all set up. We're going to do a signing there. So, I mean, there's some of them, but, you know, for the most part, I am not that interesting to them. And, you know, that's okay.
Well, at least you seem to have like a good street team out of it, you know, people who are really excited.
Well, that was another thing that was really funny was, so I help in a creative writing class in you know, one per semester, and last semester I don't even remember what I was talking about, but there was somebody who was talking, working on a short story about going into space, and I was saying something about, like, you know, the distance from here to the moon and blah 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 whatever, and they're like, wow, how do you know that? That's like really good. I'm like, well, because I write science fiction. They're like, oh yeah, I remember that. You were like viral on TikTok like 2 years ago. And it was hilarious because I literally felt myself crumbling into dust as she was speaking. It was so funny. So, but yes, they're fantastic, and they are out there. And I love working with the kids. And that I would actually prefer it this way. That I'm just this normal part of their lives and not somebody that they, you know, think of in some kind of like, oh, you know, that's, it would be way harder to do my job.
Oh my gosh. I love it so much. I'm laughing because I've had so many different similar conversations with my own students. It's just talking about, you know, some of the things I do, and they're, the one I always get is just like, I didn't know you read. What do you think I do all day? I just don't know. Yeah, I teach you how to read. Well,
what do you think? How do you think I got there?
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's the same students that look at you like you have a third head when they see you out in public, you know, just like shopping or whatever.
And I live about 45 minutes from my school, so that doesn't happen super often. But when it does, it is. It's really, you're like, oh, I know you. Oh, okay. And sometimes they wave or say, come over and say hello. And sometimes they're just going to slink away. I'm like, that's just fine. Whatever you guys want.
Oh, such delight, such delight. Well, you have a new book coming out, right?
April
Is it
9th. April 9th. It's
April
a
9th, called Ghost Station. And I've now read this book. Blew my mind. It's
Yes.
just like Dead Silence was my favorite thing to talk about for the last couple of years. I think this is going to be my favorite thing to talk about for the next couple of years until the next one.
That makes me so happy to hear that. Thank you. It's really scary. I'm very grateful that a lot of people seem to like Dead Silence, but it was also then very scary to write something else because especially I think it was this one's a little different from that. So it was, yeah. So I'm glad. Thank you for saying that.
Yes. So this is your second horror novel now, like your second full foray into horror. What has the experience been like for you over the last couple of years, kind of coming into your voice in horror?
You know, it was interesting because when I wrote Dead Silence, I think we talked about this before. I really didn't know that I was writing horror. I was just writing what intrigued and engaged me as a reader. Of course, you know, Event Horizon and Ghost Station are two of my favorite movies, so it doesn't really surprise me that all those things kind of mashed up in there in my head. But I feel like when I was there's a saying about writing, and you know, I don't remember, I can't remember. I think it might be Julia Cameron, where it's like if you think too hard about it, all of a sudden you're like a millipede aware of every limb that you're trying to operate. And I kind of feel like I had that happen because, you know, then all of a sudden I'm sitting down looking at this, you know, this second idea, this other book that I wanted to write, and I knew sort of thematically what I wanted to get at, but all of a sudden it felt like a lot more intimidating in trying to see how it was going to fit in with the horror genre, which is something I hadn't, I mean, I was so ignorant the first time, I just didn't even consider that. I just wrote what I want, which there's probably a lesson in that, which is write the story and worry about everything else later. Easier said than done. So it was a more complicated. I rewrote this book multiple times, and I think it was because each time I was getting closer to what I wanted to say, but I had a hard time getting out of my own way, if that makes sense.
I can totally understand that being, kind of the challenge. I will say this book felt to me like it was firing on all cylinders with the horror stuff.
Thank you.
It really felt really creepy and scary. And I felt like Dead Silence was super creepy and scary, but I felt like this book really comes into much more of kind of a full-throated horror space. And it works really well for a lot of different reasons. And I want to discuss those reasons with you. But before we dive into some of what this book is kind of exploring, would you share with us just what is the book about?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, by the way, for asking that, because I will jump right into details and themes and then forget to talk about what the book is about. So then everyone's
I
like,
do it every time.
what?
I get so excited to talk about the book that I just forget, like, oh, other people haven't read this yet. It's like not even out on store shelves yet. So.
So thank you for the reminder, because I'm kind of bad at that myself. Station is sci-fi horror. It is a standalone, so it is not, just to be clear, a sequel to Dead Silence. There have been some questions about that. And it is about a woman named Dr. Ophelia Bray. She is a psychologist, and she works for a corporation that, in this way, it is similar to Dead Silence, where corporations are on the leading edge of space exploration and kind of like using that for capital gains, for improving their own businesses, like the corporatization of space, essentially. And part of what they do in this world is you go out, you conquer planets, you get mining rights or mineral rights or the things that you want from that planet. But in order to keep the big guys, the big corporations, from basically grabbing up everything in sight, they have these R&E teams, which are essentially sent to kind of be a placeholder to establish residency rights so that you can say, you can't have planet A because I have a team in place there. It's mine for X number of years. And basically, that's just kind of a preventative, you know, everybody agreed we have to do this sort of thing. So the problem with that is with so many people living and working in space, we're seeing an increase in psychological and physiological damage because we've never had people away from Earth for so long. You know, this is sort of based on the winter over syndrome, which is a real thing here in the Arctic and Antarctic stations. And you basically have, you know, your depression, your anxiety, your stress, that sort of thing. But you also can have hallucinations, delusions, violence, you know, suicidal ideation, all of that stuff. So They're trying to, they being Ophelia and the other psychologists are trying to treat this syndrome both with therapy and whatever to make sure that we're not losing our workforce. Our workforce must be out there and healthy. So she's sent out with a team that suffered a loss recently from this syndrome, Eckhart-Reiser syndrome, and they do not want her there. And she does not, you know how to convince them to trust her because she has some pretty big secrets that she's hiding. And they also have some secrets from her. And they end up on this planet that is abandoned. There is nothing. There's no one living on the planet as far as we know. But there are alien ruins and it's an abandoned habitat from the previous owner. And lots of creepy stuff ensues.
But plenty of creepy stuff ensues. I was like, why am I reading this at night? I really should not be reading it at night.
You know, so what bothered funny. What bothered me more or most are the scenes. Like I felt like I was itching. You know, like I felt like I was, ooh, yeah. My skin was itching all over the place. You know, like there's something crawling on me. Mm-hmm. That actually bothered me when I was writing certain sections of this book, because I mean, I have that anyway, because I just get, I don't know, bugs. Blah. So, you know, but it was there, that actually bothered me the most out of writing all of those scenes.
I totally believe it. I don't want to spoil exactly what you're talking about, but I know that scene. I know those feelings. I was like, ooh, this is like, we're getting into really like weird squeamish body horror here.
Body horror. Yeah. A little bit. Yeah. We venture into that just a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much that this book does that I think is really, really well. Let's start with kind of this big, broad overview of the world building that you've, you know, kind of put into this book, the way that corporate interests kind of shape the space race and, you know, kind of the tech race, the kind of total corporatization of the characters and their interactions with one another, because this is such a strong element of the book. I feel like it was very much present in Dead Silence, mm-hmm. but here it is that much more full-throated and in a way a lot more critical, I think, of this specific type of corporatization. So what was some of the impulse there, and you know, what were some of the themes that you really wanted to explore about this, you know, kind of idea of like the space race being just mm-hmm. another component of kind of like a human capital market?
How to make more money. You know, how do we use this to make money? I think obviously based a lot on my experiences of our world as it is now, I would love to write a utopian Star Trekian sort of future where we all care about each other and take care of each other. And, you know, I really love that that exists, but I kind of feel like I'm torn in a lot of ways, because obviously I, as somebody who's interested in science fiction, I want there to be a forward movement in space exploration. I don't love that it's all through privatized entities like corporations, you know, right now, Amazon, whatever, you know what I mean? I don't like that versus, you know, NASA or, you know, the European Space Agency or whatever. So it's hard, but I also kind of feel like that's, you know, the people who are the most motivated to get to space are probably the people who are going to make money on it and human beings. So my theory, if I have a theme for anything that I write in horror, which Lord only knows, I'll probably eat my words if not sooner rather than later. It's that you can have monsters, you can have ghosts, you can have aliens, you can have whatever you have. But to me, it's almost always the humans and what they're doing that are the most harmful. I'm not exactly sure where that comes from. I mean, like, I don't know why. So to me, like, you know, even when there are ghosts or aliens or monsters or whatever, it's the human beings who've sent you out there. It's the people who are making money on your back. They're the ones who are putting you in danger. And I feel like as long, and people make me, it sounds like I'm against capitalism. I'm technically, as an author, I'm an entrepreneur. I mean, I'm not against that, but I am against where we are just crushing people in order to make money. There has to be a way to balance that. I have no idea how. So I guess in some of these stories, I'm taking it to the extreme to show what I don't want to have happen, what I hope will not happen. And also on the other side, you know, I think about things too, in this story in particular, healthcare or insurance and being able to provide, you know, certain procedures or surgeries or treatments is limited by insurance, and you can't have insurance unless you're working, etc. I kept that because I think that's one of the most horrible things about our current environment and what it forces people to do, or what it forces them to get to go by, to, you know, get by without. So I think a lot of this comes from my frustration of our current existence and setup, and taking it to an extreme where I can sort of make that point in that Star Trek way where, you know, it's like, you know, we're going to exaggerate it. But I really honestly don't think, I mean, in the story, there's a point where they're talking about, look, it's cheaper if we send human miners out to do this rather than, you know, machines, because they're cheaper than machines. Humans are an unending resource, essentially. And we have people lining up to take these jobs. And hey, if we stuff them into essentially stasis for a month at a time, we don't have to pay to feed them. We're not thinking necessarily about what that does to them physically or what that does to them mentally, because it doesn't matter. It's all about the almighty dollar. Ooh, that's my dad. Sorry. That's my dad coming through. So you can blame him for some of this. So I think that all of those things are kind of my frustration, because I love innovation and I love people who strike out on their own, but I just hate this idea that we have to just, that people are dying under the boots of capitalism.
It's one of the things that, like, forgive me for saying this, I'm very anti-capitalist. I feel a deep and bitter frustration at its ethics, because I think that, you know, there's a lot of talk about the ethics of capitalism and, like, how can we have ethical capitalism? And for me, you know, the older I get, the more I experience the way that this system works. It's like there really is no ethical treatment under capitalism. It is an unethical system to begin with. So how do we deal with that? You know, a lot of talk is given over to, like, can we somehow rope it in? Can we constrain capitalism in a way so that maybe the inequality isn't as pronounced as it is right now? And I find that to be, you know, like, only tasteful to a point. It's like, yes, I believe that's the first step, maybe, but it can't be the ultimate step, because the inequality that promotes the kinds of atrocities that we've seen historically continue to exist, right? Like, it's just always going to keep happening. And I think that's one of the reasons why Ghost Station hits so hard for me, because I think that what you're grappling with regards to this, you know, capital venture ties into a lot of the same class politics that we struggle with today. Mm-hmm. And you do a really interesting thing in this book, which is give us a main character in Ophelia Bray, who is from this, you know, system. She's one of these kind of OG Vanderbilt, or, you know, like a Carnegie, you know, kind of character. She comes from this incredible money, and yet she also has ties, like she has a background that's connected to the working class. And so she has this kind of, like, struggle, interior struggle, where she has to recognize her privilege and also recognize the lack of privilege in those around her, the limitations of her privilege, and still try to figure out how do I navigate this social space? How do I build a connection when there is a clear class difference? And maybe my similarity is greater to these folks than, you know, to this Bray family that, you know, kind of stands out in the middle of space. But how do you find class solidarity, you know, with a group that is so beaten up on? You know, what do you do to build trust when they are distrustful of you? And it's this fascinating character study and exploration, I think, of the hopeful part of humanity, where we are more invested in building bridges to people than we are building monuments to capital. And it plays out through the whole book. There's never a moment when that conflict does not exist for Ophelia. And I love that.
It, you know, that was one of the things, because honestly, that was one of the things I was trying to figure out. I knew that she couldn't belong. She doesn't belong anywhere. And that is her struggle. And I think a lot of us feel that way in different ways, not necessarily in the difference, you know, being caught between two different classes or whatever. That was what was intriguing to me, because she certainly has things in common with the crew, some of which she cannot share with them. Her own family despises her for a variety of reasons. And I think some of it is about struggling with her and what you're born into and who you choose to be, how much choice you have in who you are. Because a lot of that is, you know, you don't have options. Sometimes your options are ugly and you can only make certain choices. I mean, you know, it's not as free as as we would like to think. I mean, some of the people in this story make really hard choices. And I hope that even though we don't like those choices, that we understand them. That was what I wanted to get across, is that there, you know, are certainly evil. There is certainly evil, but it's most of the time it's just people being human and making flawed choices because they're in a difficult situation and they're doing the best they can. You know, I'm always intrigued by people in situations where there isn't trust, especially in a horror story, because you just don't know. To me, that's more interesting when you don't know where the danger is coming from, and there is that inherent distrust of anything that is other, regardless of what that is. And Ophelia herself, because she does struggle with her identity so much, with being caught between these two different worlds and feeling like she doesn't belong in either one, and I think even to some extent feeling shame for both parts of who she is, she doesn't really trust herself. You know, I think she kind of has this, you know, feeling that one day she's going to wake up and, you know, the Bray part of her is going to say something or do something. And I do think you see that sometimes where she gets kind of imperious, because what do we do when we're stressed? We fall back on the things that we know, even if we don't love how that was used against us as children or as young adults. And I think she also fears, you know, the worst side of herself coming out and not knowing if she's going to be able to control that. And I don't know, I just found that to me was the most interesting part, is how much of who you are is within your control. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I came to an answer with that, but that's really one of the things that I was wrestling with for this book.
Well, and it comes out so clearly in the conflict for the characters. I mean, just from a craft perspective, you know, when you write characters, what you're really trying to do is explore avenues of conflict for them. And I often find that the least interesting component of any book is the external conflict, you know, the external conflict that forces them into action. That's just plot. What really drives character, what really makes for a dynamic character, is a character who has a lot of that internal conflict. The way that they see themselves and the way that they wish to be seen, and what they want or what they need and what they can't have based on the limitations of who they are, all of that comes together into really rich internal conflict. I see Ghost Station talked about a lot in little review circles or in a lot of the kind of marketing blurb for it as a psychological thriller. And I think that a lot of what drives that perception of it being a psychological thriller is because we are so deeply ingrained in Ophelia's experience and the conflict she feels between what she wishes she could be or do and what she cannot be and do. And that rich interior conflict spills out into one of the things that I think makes this book so magnificent to read.
Thank you very much. That's awesome. You know, it's funny. I have heard, and I've had, I think my best friend from college is the one that she read this. She read an early draft of it. And she's like, you know that she should not be a psychologist, right? And I'm like, yes, I am aware. You know, and I did that deliberately because I feel like the people who, and I include myself with this because I think writers do the same thing. But a lot of people who are in helping professions go into helping professions, not just because they want to help people, because they're also trying to understand what happened to them and how to not help themselves, because that sounds like the wrong, that sounds selfishly motivated, but that's not it, but just trying to understand and untangle, you know? So I definitely think that while Ophelia is definitely driven, incredibly driven to help others, and sometimes her motivation for that is confusing, is from multiple areas. It's not selfless. It's not entirely selfless anyway, but also it's about, you know, from this really, really messed up environment, this, and I you know, I don't know who I am. And maybe if I can't help me, I can help you. And that at least gives me an identity. I am the person who helps you. Forget all the stuff that happened in my past. That way I don't have to deal with it, but I'm just going to help you and I'm going to help the crap out of you. So like that's, you know what I mean? That is her. So glad you said that about the internal conflict, because to me, I agree with you wholeheartedly. The internal conflict in any story that I have worked on, I hope there's a guy that I think it's Michael Haig, but he was talking about how when we talk about a story, we talk about, oh, and then there's a car crash and then there's a monster chasing you, whatever. We talk about the external stuff, but the stuff that really sticks with us, the stuff that resonates with us is the emotional, the internal conflict, the people trying to figure it out, because that's actually what we're learning from. You know, we're, you know, sort of vicariously learning how to be a better human, hopefully, or that we're not alone in our struggles. And so I really hope that comes through with Ophelia, because yeah, she, Claire in some ways in Dead Silence was a lot easier to write. Ophelia gave me a run for my money. I'm glad that comes through, and I'm because I was worried that it was just going to make her seem sort of scattered and all over the place, because she is very torn. So
I will admit I've scoured reviews on Goodreads, because I am always just like, I don't know, maybe there's like an elitist part of me where when I love something a lot, I have to look at people who disagree with me so I can be like, you are wrong, you know?
You know nothing.
Yeah. And so I've been, you know, there are a lot of like really great reactions where people are like, I love Ophelia. Like, she's such an interesting character. And then others who are like, I hate this main character and I don't know what's happening. And I'm like, you are missing the point.
That makes me, thank you for saying that, because I, you know, I try very hard to stay clear of things, because I am I'm a writer. I'm a sensitive person. So I try to stay clear of some of that, but I've definitely seen that. And, you know, I think it's because in some ways Claire has a little element of what do I want to say? She is who I hope I would be if I were in a difficult situation, where she's really trying her best. She's messed up, but she's trying. Yeah. And she's still managing to kind of be a leader and pull things together. Ophelia is sort of a train wreck. I mean, she just is, and she is trying, but it's her train wreck that is part of the story. You know what I mean? Like that's why it is that way. If she were Claire in this situation, it wouldn't work. You don't have the same level of tension, because part of what makes the story engine run is you don't know what's going on with her, and you don't know what she's going to do, because, you know, she has all these conflicting ideas and obviously these very dark secrets. So I am very grateful that comes through, and that made sense to you, because I have definitely seen that where they're like, she's unlikable. I've seen several people say this entire crew is unlikable. I'm like, you don't like Suresh? Suresh is my favorite part. He's such a jerk and he's so much fun. Oh my gosh. I had so much fun writing Suresh.
There are moments when Suresh is just almost like the stand-in for the audience, just heckling the plot.
Yes.
And I'm like, I hate this guy, but I kind of like having him around, because he kind of says the things that I think we're all thinking in the moment. I love it.
Yes. Suresh made me think of, I don't know if you've ever seen National Treasure with Nicolas Cage.
Yes,
and
of course.
I love that movie. And Riley, and they're like getting ready to go. Like, they're in that, like, they're going to go down into like the tomb. He's like, all right, who's going to be first to go down the big scary hole? And I was like, that's Suresh. We're going to do this? Why are we doing this? This makes no sense. I just had a blast with him. So it, you know what? So if people don't like him, that's okay. I'm fine. I'm fine with that. I'm fine with any of it, obviously. But I really had fun writing him. I looked forward to, you know, his interactions with Ophelia.
I do want to explore some of this idea of like, should a character be likable? You know, does a main character actually need to be likable? Because I felt like the point of Ophelia wasn't necessarily to be like, look how likable she is. It's more an exploration of like, I mean, she's a human being in extraordinary circumstances, has had to go through extraordinary things in her own life. And she does not know how to cope with those things, you know, to really deal with those things. So I felt like, you know, one of the questions I posed to you in kind of organizing for this episode is, this idea of like, how does a nurturer nurture if they struggle with the very act of being human? You know, how does someone attempt to help or be able to help if they don't know what kind of help they need? It's a fascinating question, I think, not just for psychology, but I think mm-hmm. just for being a human being. You know, how can we help in putting something together, you know, putting life together, putting meaning into our lives, if we don't have structure to begin with, you know, to build those blocks together? And I think that's Ophelia's journey. You know, she has no clue what it is that she actually needs. And there is a perpetual stumbling of trying to figure it out.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there's a line in there where she was, she's talking, I think Liana is talking to her, and she says something about Ava, the crew member who's deceased. And she says, well, you know, she was such a mom, you know, that's, you know, Ophelia says, oh, you know, yeah, but she's basically saying, so I imagine, because, you know, she's never known, she knows what Liana is talking about, but her experience of mothering, nurturing, to use that word, is not nurturing at all. I mean, it's sort of like when you grow up in an abusive household, or you grow up in a household where things are strange, you don't know that that's not normal. You don't know it until you are exposed to, you know, other ways of living. And I think that's sort of what she struggles with. I think she has, you know, she's gotten her education, she has learned, she has watched, she's very, Ophelia is very observant. But I think, you know, what I think about, like, you know, when I'm sick or when I'm not feeling well, I think about, you know, oh, my mom would put a washcloth on my head, you know, if I'm not, whatever. If you don't have that experience, if you don't know how to take care of somebody because you were never taken care of, then this is certainly an ongoing process. And I think to some extent, she keeps people at a professional distance, because that way she knows how to help. She knows the questions to ask. She knows how to set up a room so that, you know, people are comfortable. But when it comes to actual personal relationships, letting people in, she doesn't know how to deal with that. And it scares her. So I think that's one of the things she struggles with at the beginning with Julius. I think it's one of the things that she struggles with basically through the whole book until the end, where she's kind of like, okay, I'm with these people. Mm-hmm. This is it. I mean, she wants to belong, but I don't think she understands how to do that.
Yeah. I one of the things that also struck me about Ophelia, which ties into, you know, kind of more of this concept of like human identity making, I guess, like how do we come into ourselves? Ophelia, when she first starts interacting with her crew, it's like she has like these trinkets. She has like these VR goggles, right?
Yep.
That she is like, this is going to help you sleep. You know, it's going to help you get like good REM sleep. It's comforting. And it's like she uses the technology as a surrogate for the actual skill set that she needs in order to, you know, kind of be that nurturer. And I feel like, isn't that just kind of like a microcosm of like the problem of consumerism in and of itself? It's like, instead of really approaching the existential problems, the existential crisis of being human, it's like, well, what if you just hide behind this gadget that could solve your problems for you? You know, would you have such a problem if you just got an automatic dishwasher, you know, or something like that?
Yeah.
And it's like that's not the existential problem we're facing. And then when Ophelia kind of runs up against like, maybe the problem is bigger than what a VR headset can solve, she's clueless about how to help otherwise. You know, she can't quite figure out how to navigate that. It again, this is like layers and layers of how smart this book is.
I have to say to you, I think that glad that you picked up on those things. I don't think that I did those deliberately, so I'm really glad that I would love to take credit for being that smart. I don't think that that is the case. I do think, to your point, in a lot of ways, Ophelia does remind me somewhat of myself in that, you know, I approach things like, oh, well, this is what's worked in the past, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to do this, this, and this. And so she's very routine, very, this is how things work. So one of the fun things about this story for me was taking that, you know, fish out of water element and just dumping. I mean, she's really not meant to be in this environment. She's not, this is not good for her. She doesn't know how to do it. Nothing is routine, essentially. And I do think she relies on the tools, because that's what people, isn't that what we, you know, what people tell us to do, you know, oh, well, just take this vitamin and all your problems will be solved. Oh, you know, just do this and you'll live forever or whatever. I mean, she's very much following that prescription because that's the only thing that she knows, because the human element of bonding, of having actual friends, of having family, of having true connection is not something that she has really experienced at the beginning of this. She's always sort of had that distance. So I definitely think there is an element of that. And I think that if the farther you get into the story, you know, the more that she's in over her head and the less she relies on those things, because she's realized this is a teacup, you know, and the ship is sinking. I can't bail fast enough. Like this is not going to do it. This is not going to do it.
We've talked a lot about what I think a lot of the book is kind of doing, broadening out, if we can. You know, I thought I might pose to you the idea of just, you know, so in this meaning making, which I think is what a lot of us are trying to do at this moment, is like this cognitive mapping, you know, trying to figure out who we are in relation to one another, in our relationship to society, you know, in yeah, our communities. You know, how does art serve a purpose in that kind of meaning making? Either the creation of art, you know, you as an artist writing things, or as a reader, you know, someone who is kind of consuming art and acting with it, you know, how does that help shape our ability to human?
I think those are fantastic questions. For myself, I think that, although I would probably never put it this way, I don't think I like to think about the things I struggle with. So obviously, capitalism versus empathy, versus caring for your fellow people, that's something that I think about a lot. You know, one of the things I'm thinking about now, that may come into play in a story is, you know, where do we fit entertainment and the trauma of, say, for example, true crime, you know, so those sort of things that I wrestle with, I think find their way into stories. I think that I never ever want to put a message or preach or from that perspective, I do hope that it causes people to think about stuff. Maybe they don't even come to a conclusion. I'm not even sure I've come to conclusions as I'm still wrestling with things, but I hope that it makes people think about stuff. You know, again, going back to Star Trek, one of the coolest things about sci-fi is you can take something and set it in a time and a place that is distant from us that will help people see things more clearly. And you would say, oh, well, I would never want to be, you know, those guys. And you're like, yeah, but you are on the side of the Romulans. You mean they're not Romulans, but they're, you know what I mean? They're here on this, whatever it is. I mean, that was the first example that popped to mind. I hope that art, both for the artist, is an exploration of things that we wrestle with. And I hope that for the reader, it causes them to think about it. I mean, I don't even know that you can say that it causes them to wrestle with it, because I think that has to come from that has to come internally. But at least maybe it flags it and says, "Hey, this is something somebody else is thinking about. What do I think about this?" And I think that a lot of that, I think a lot of those things now, or I contemplate a lot of those things, because so much of what goes on in our world politically, everything seems to be very divisive. And sometimes I look at things and I go, I don't understand how someone who grew up in the same country, relatively the same, you know, everything, you know, socioeconomic status, whatever, how can they think this? I don't understand. It's not a judgment necessarily, but a lack of understanding of, you know, why truly seems to believe that the moon landing was faked, as a funny example off the top of my head. I mean, but there certainly are people who really genuinely do believe that. You know, that kind of thing is something that, as I'm thinking about all of these things in our world today, a lot of those things, the things that frustrate me, the lack of empathy, the way that we don't take care of others, I think I try to thread, that stuff ends up being threaded through. Again, it's not always intentional. Mm-hmm. It just sort of happens that way, you know?
Yeah. I think you're totally right. We talk about this a lot in literature classes, you know, when I'm talking with students and trying to interpret literature, you know, to be like, okay, so there is meaning here. I'm not going to say that there, you know, your reading, your interpretation of this text is wrong, because I don't think that's necessarily true. I think for any art to create meaning, like it's gotta be more collaborative than just,
it is, yeah.
You know, so when you're reading and you get something out of a text and you see it in that light, that's not to say that it's like not the intended reading, you know, like there is a validity in how you interpret things. But, you know, we kind of have to have this kind of back and forth. We, you know, there needs to be an understanding of how things are explicitly textual and then how some things are intuitively textual, or, you know, sometimes metatextual. Mm-hmm. You know, the intersection of all of these things, you know, kind of can come together and really create meaning. And, you know, to your point, sometimes it's not intentional on your part, you know, sometimes it is unconscious, it's, you know, a decision that you make for the book, but it's still there, you know, and it can enrich our experience. And I think that, you know, I continue to think about, like, what's the function of art in my life, with my own unique experiences that I bring to the table and my particular needs of art. You know, what do I need from this text to do for me in order for it to be a satisfactory experience? And, you know, that's absolutely different for me than it is for other people. But there's a richness to art, and I come to art specifically for the perspectives that expands what I'm thinking about, you know, to pose a question to me that maybe helps me interrogate my own feelings, or, you know, gives me a counterpoint that maybe then I can use to, you know, kind of like edify my own feelings about things. You know, can this challenge some of my notions? And then can I work through that? You know, is there a way that this can help shape some of the conversation? It doesn't have to change me radically, right?
No. Mm-mm.
Like, I don't think that needs to be art's purpose. But what I do want art to do is open up a conversation that then, you know, the door is open, and now we have something through which we can build meaning. You know, we can begin to kind of understand our interaction with one another. I find great beauty and comfort in that. You know, if there's any utopian longing in something as so scary and frustrating and nightmarish as Ghost Station, you know, I feel it's like, this is the kind of book that opens up the door to asking questions. You know, I shared with you my questions, and thank you so much for, you know, not just writing the book, but for being so game to come in and engage with those questions meaningfully. Because I feel like, again, this is the power of art, is the conversation around it.
I definitely think that's true. I think it's interesting because, you know, at one point in my career, someone had said to me, because I was, I think, moaning about, you know, not being published again, because I go, you always, that's always the thing you worry about as a writer is, you know, like, no one is ever going to read my stories again. And someone said, you know, well, you can always write. And it took me a while to figure out why that frustrated me, because of course I can. I mean, I'm sure there are tons of other writers who have filled notebooks with stories and novels and, you know, they've never seen the light of day. And that is correct. And I certainly do enjoy the process of writing, obviously, but there is a huge value in making it a two-way communication. In other words, not just something that I create, but something that I put out there for other people to respond to, for them to bring their lens of experience to. And I feel like, ego, I don't know, but I feel like I would not be as satisfied exploring those issues and then tucking them away in a drawer. I definitely feel like there is something to putting it out there and having the conversation and seeing what other people see. A lot of times people find things that I was not intending, and not in a bad way necessarily. I remember one of my first books, which was about a girl who was horribly mean, a ghost. She was a mean girl ghost from high school. And she would find herself disappearing when she would say mean things, you know, like she would start to vanish. And she had to eventually figure out that, you know, whatever. I mean, it was largely a very on the nose metaphor, but someone was like, oh, and I really liked the message of be kind. And I was like, well, that was not it. I was actually having fun in torturing her because, you know, she was being herself and she would vanish and then she would have to come back and then she'd be like, fine, everything is great. I really like your shirt from Walmart. Like whatever mean thing she was saying, you know what I mean? It was more about, to me, the entertainment, but it was interesting. So I do feel like stories, like everything, are communication. Stephen King has that great section in his book On Writing about, you know, putting an image in your mind about a rabbit in a tank on a tablecloth that's red. I mean, it really is. It is distant, but it is a two-way communication. And I, you know, then you respond to this idea that's being put forth out there. And I, you know, sat through enough literary criticism classes that, you know, I, as an English major, that, you know, just because I had an idea going in, that does not make, people will come to that differently, you know, and that's okay. That's the way it should be. Everyone should respond to art in the way that their lens of experience speaks to them, that brings forth this meaning to them. You know, all of that, though, I will tell you that my goal in all of this, while I love the idea of wrestling with these sort of weighty issues, is mainly, I just want to make people have, you know, have fun. I want, the best compliment I ever received was an email I got right after Dead Silence came out from someone who was in the hospital having surgery. And they said, you know, the first thing I did when I woke up was ask for them to give me my book, because my Dead Silence, because I wanted to finish it. I had to know what happened. And I was like, okay, that's what I want. For people who are struggling, for the people who feel alone or whatever, I want these stories to take them away somewhere else where they can worry about, you know, ghosts or aliens or, you know, this strange psychologist who doesn't seem to be very good at her job.
I love that mission, and allow me to say, as deep as I went into, you know, a lot of the bigger issues of Ghost Station, I love everything else about it. Like it was definitely a book where I was like, I don't want to put this down. I really want to read this book. The reading was a really great experience. So
thanks. That was it. You know, because that's what I like from books. I like books that, you know, are going to make me think about stuff later that stick with me. But also, mm-hmm. I just want something that I'm like, you know what? I have had a long day and I just want to be somewhere else for a while.
Yes.
And that to me, I feel like if I do that, then, you know, even if they don't like Ophelia, that's okay. I successfully transported you somewhere else where you're now worried about what's happening on this crazy little made up planet.
Well, I know it's early to ask because Ghost Station is not even out on shelves yet, but do you have any like further works in the process? Anything to like get hyped up for?
I do. I have another book that for right now that I hope will stay this way is scheduled to come out in 2025, so just next year.
Oh,
and
I'm so excited.
It is, the first draft is turned in and I'm going to be getting edits, I'm sure, shortly. They're working on cover concepts, which is always a fun thing. I believe the title will be staying as Cold Eternity. And it is about...
I'm sorry. I like it. What? This is the coolest title.
It was not originally called that. The original title was Elysian Fields. And my editor, to her credit, was like, no one's going to know how to say that or spell that. I'm like, okay, that's fair.
No classical readers in the group, I guess. Yeah.
Well, and I think just because, you know, it is the name of the ship, we kept it as the name of the ship in the story. But Cold Eternity, it does make its point. And this, I just kind of loved this because, again, occasionally I think my parents are like, what did we do? You are so strange. But... I, you know, think about, and I think I truly am on some level obsessed with thinking about death or the process of what we do when people die and the rituals and whatever. Mm. And I was thinking about it, you know, in the future, in this future that is taking place in cold eternity, you have people who are living under domes, you know, on the moon and Mars and whatever, and you have some terraforming going on, and you have people who are living on space stations or ships. What do we do with the dead? If you are on a planet, you could maybe bury them, but then you're giving up, you know, arable, you're giving up fields basically that you might need to grow for food. You know, cremation at this point still causes massive pollution and, you know, greenhouse gases and all these other weird things, you know, like there's weird side effects from that. And you can't just like, you know, randomly shoot bodies out of a ship. People might crash into them, cause damage. So I'm thinking, okay, you know, what would we do in this kind of burgeoning, you know, we're now living in space. What do we, how do our rituals for the dead change? And I was sort of thinking about, you know, right now, obviously in our current society, cryogenesis isn't, it's not a, you, it, we can't, we can freeze you, but we can't get you back out. So like, you know, we can freeze you, but you know, we don't know how to undo that without damaging your cells. So I was thinking sort of about this rich guy, kind of a Elon Musk type, who might be like, here, you know, basically join in my cult. I have this huge ship that I'm gonna transform into this sort of preservation, and you can come and be frozen. You can pay a lot of money, and then, you know, in 50 years or 75 years, when we figured out, you know, how to wait, how to wake you up and how to cure whatever it is that you've died from, then you can, you know, you can come back, and it'll, you know, all will be grand with the world. And so he's kind of this magnetic sort of leader, charismatic leader. And of course the problem is that, you know, 150 years on, which is when the story takes place, these ships called the dead ships, have not, they've not figured out any of this stuff. So there's just these ships that are kind of floating around full of rich people paid to be preserved. And they're out there in space because the money is still going. And my main character is someone who has gotten into trouble in her life, and so she is fleeing. And she ends up kind of as a caretaker on one of these dead ships called Elysian Fields, which is where Cold Eternity comes from.
I'm so into this concept. I'm gonna lose my mind over here.
Was, so I will tell you, I had to have a break because Ophelia, hard to write because she doubts her own sanity so much. She doubts her own ability, she doubts what she's sensing. And that was really, really important for who she is. But dude, I could not write another book like that in a row. It was such a heavy lift because you have to think about things how you would think about them, then how she would think about them, then how she would think about them after not having any sleep and possibly being, you know, affected by factor. It was just like, oh, I can't do this. So my main character in this story in Cold Eternity, doesn't believe in anything supernatural, paranormal. She's not afraid of any of that crap. She's not afraid of the dead ship, of the dead people on the ship. She didn't believe in any of that. She's just going because she needs a place to hide out from these people who are after her. And the funny thing about that to me was then, you know, those of us who are horror aficionados, you know, things are happening and she's like, oh, that's just this. And you're like, no, those are bones. Those are bones. Come on. So it was really, really fun to go the opposite direction to somebody who is just like, I don't need to be scared by this. Nothing can hurt me here. You know what I mean? And you're like, oh, no. So I hope I, you know, to the point where I hope it's not the, you know, I'm just going to go down the basement. There's nothing scary. I hope it's not quite that bad, but I, to the point where, you know, it's enjoyable because we know more than she does. And that, I, that was a lot of fun to write.
Oh, well, I am super excited for it. Ghost Station comes out April 9th, 2024. Where can people find you online if they would like to follow more of your writing journey?
They can mute my best place to find me is probably Instagram, where I'm at author Stacey, Stacey Kade, Stacey Kade. That's probably the place I'm most active. I am on various other places, including Threads, Twitter, and Facebook, but I'm probably best at Instagram.
All right. It's always a delight to talk to you. I genuinely just cherish and covet this time. So thank you so much for sharing it with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I love our conversations.